You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
And what are we considering today? God's Hero versus Man's Hero. That's the title of this program, God's Hero versus Man's Hero. If that sounds like a competition, it was something much more intense than that. God's hero was Pope Pius VII. Man's hero was Napoleon Bonaparte. In the two decades, just before and after 1800, they had a confrontation that was spectacular in an age that was spectacular. Both these famous men's reputation were at stake, and the admiration of the people of Europe was eventually to be won by one or other of the men. We'll see what happened. I'll summarize a little up front and then go back for the details, because it's a fascinating story. In the late spring, 1812, very significant year in history, right? There occurred in Italy and France one of the great sacrileges of history. Pope Pius VII, who had been held a prisoner at Savonia near Genoa by the Emperor Napoleon I since 1809. In other words, 3 years. Napoleon wanted to interrogate the Pope face to face, so he ordered that the Pope be cruelly dragged over the Alps, in precarious health, to Fontainebleau in Paris. The Pope arrived at the gates of Fontainebleau Castle nearly a corpse. Shortly before this excruciating journey that the Pope made, Napoleon had written to Prince Borghese at Turin, quote, "Precautions will be taken to see that Pius VII passes through Turin at night, that he passes Chambéry and Lyon at night. The Pope must not travel in his pontifical robes, but in such a way that nowhere can he be recognized," unquote. The Emperor Napoleon's orders were executed with brutal precision. Clad in the black cassock of a common priest, the Supreme Pontiff was bundled into a carriage in the deep of night, with only his quack doctor, the doctor provided by Napoleon, for a companion, and dispatched, already ill, northward to France. High in the Alps, his bowels became blocked. He could not urinate for days, and his agony as the horses galloped on was unbearable. Delirious with fever, the Pope cried out that he would throw himself on the road and die there if he were forced to go on. Yet he was compelled to continue. As the papal carriage galloped through Lyon at midnight, the pontiff gazed up at his physician and murmured of Napoleon, "May God forgive him, I already have." By some miracle, the Pope survived and reached Fontainebleau alive. He had been to Fontainebleau before, as Napoleon's guest 8 years earlier, when he first came to France to anoint and crown the Corsican man
as Emperor of France.
By the time the Pope reached Paris,
Napoleon had decided to crown himself while the Pope sat at his side and watched.
But despite the discourtesy, the two men admired and did like each other for a time. Soon they fell out, embroiled in a bitter quarrel over the respective powers, over the kingdoms of Christ and the kingdoms of Caesar. Isn't this an old story? Caesar wrote, "Papism always raises its head again." The Pope's imprisonment had begun 3 years earlier than this excruciating trip. Back in 1809, a young French general, acting under Emperor Napoleon's instruction to, quote, "shut the Pope up," this young general kidnapped the Pope from Rome
and put him in prison.
In all, Napoleon held Pius VII prisoner for nearly 5 years. Not content to be emperor, Napoleon, the very definition of a megalomaniac, indeed he's a symbol for it in history, Napoleon coveted the powers of the papacy as well. To that end, he subjected the pontiff to extraordinary trial and humiliations. Doses of morphine, for example, were administered by the Pope's quack doctor under the guise of sedatives to induce the pontiff to bow to the emperor's demands. The Pope's entourage reported to Paris that at times the Pope was in a frenzy. It's interesting how this prefigures the imprisonment and torture, and indeed the brainwashing, of the great Cardinal Benzenti of Hungary. that occurred in the 20th century. Just as in Menzenti's case, it appeared to be working at some times, but ultimately did not. Napoleon was a political and military genius, whatever his personal character. He was ambitious, perceptive, impatient, ruthless. What was Pope Pius VII like? He preferred his former life as a monk to that of the papacy. He was sensitive, scrupulous, had a wonderful sense of humor. He certainly was physically frail. And some people found him detached, otherworldly. Of course, at one point, the Pope did excommunicate Napoleon, making him an outcast to the faithful. Napoleon was an immense figure in history. He's been described in all sorts of ways. Savior of Europe, an emancipator disguised as a despot. But at times, he seemed to be a squalid little gangster, the precursor of Hitler, committing blasphemy against the Roman pontiff. Sigmund Freud characteristically wrote of him, describing Napoleon as that magnificent rascal Napoleon, who remained fixated on his puberty fantasies, was blessed with incredibly good luck, inhibited by no ties except his family, and made his way through life like a sleepwalker until he was finally shipwrecked by his grand follies. He was an absolute classic anti-gentleman to be cut on a grand scale. The artistic world was in love with him, this man of hope and ideals. In the 19th century, the romantic poems were written about him. For a while, saw him as the new Prometheus, at war with the heavenly powers and daring them to strike him down, like Prometheus stealing the fire of heaven. Napoleon snatched the crown from the Pope's hand, then snatched Rome itself, and got excommunicated for it. It was Napoleon's overreach that brought him down. Napoleon certainly had a contradictory character, and his personality escapes the usual boundaries of definition. A contemporary described him as someone who was neither good nor violent, neither gentle nor cruel. Such a being, having no equivalent, could neither feel nor arouse the slightest sympathy. Napoleon was a man endowed with amazing ability and a dangerous degree of ambition. He could face adversity with firmness and majesty, but could also be carried away to the point of frenzy when his passions met with opposition. Historians have struggled to capture his personality, and they resort to comparisons with Caesar, Alexander the Great, or sometimes even Hitler. Napoleon could be mild and stern, kind and unforgiving, generous and egotistical, far-seeing and short-sighted. There was a French historian, Georges Lefebvre, who detected several personalities beneath the soldier's uniform of the young Napoleon. Another historian saw Napoleon's changeable and contradictory character and mercurial moods, the ability to adjust to and to exploit any situation. Another historian, Philip Dwyer, wrote that Napoleon could be talented, intelligent, and passionate, and capable of inspiring others, but also petty, vindictive, and callous concerning the lives of others. In his final forced retirement on the island of St. Helena, he wrote about himself and about his life, and what he wrote was propaganda. It was a myth, and it came apart. He attempted to construct an image of himself as a peacemaker, while so obviously he had pursued confrontation. His foreign policy was nothing but a criminal enterprise. Duplicity carried Napoleon a certain distance. While occupied with one activity, he was always planning another. Even Napoleon's advisors came to disapprove of his enthusiasm for war. He was always surrounded by his adoring troops. And how did he manage to generate loyalty among his men? "I do not make a profession of war," he contended, "and no one is more peaceful than I." Justifying the continuation of hostilities in this manner permitted his plans for confrontation to be extended indefinitely. By insisting on his pacific nature, a gap opened between myth and reality, damaging his credibility and ultimately all of his support. "Power is my mistress," Napoleon once said. "I've done too much for her conquest to let anyone abduct or even covet her." He was a chameleon, able to change appearance at will to adapt to his surrounding and allow others to see in him what they wanted. And this fooled many people, including Ludwig von Beethoven.
Napoleon Bonaparte even fool Ludwig von Beethoven, who was no fool and a skeptic. But he was greatly inspired by the vision of a hero, of man's hero, in Napoleon Bonaparte. Beethoven wrote his Third Symphony, the Napoleon Symphony. The Third Symphony is Beethoven's most magnificent work, I think, other than the last string quartets. It's certainly the best of the nine, and it's groundbreaking, the difference between the First and Second Symphonies. And the Third Symphony is like a great leap in time and space. It's as if Beethoven passed through a time warp into a far distant future, a galactic future, a divinely inspired future. Of course, Beethoven was Catholic, we must mention that, which he later titled Eroica, having torn up the title page when Napoleon declared himself emperor. The original title page dedicated it to Napoleon Bonaparte. But that was soon changed. And he titled it To a Hero, the Eroica to a Hero. The Eroica Symphony depicts magnificently noble emotions, the human emotions, compassion, a brave ferocity in the defense of virtue, a triumphant belief in the divine. But it was not the real Napoleon. It was Napoleon that Beethoven invented in his mind and soul and projected onto this man. And projected it out of excessive hope onto this man, onto this man's hero. Well, we still have this music with us, don't we? Every day we have this music with us. I listen to it all the time. This depiction of a noble soul, of what might have been, had Napoleon been God's hero as well as man's hero. We'll break now. This is Chuck Coughlin, back in a moment.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
Now, if you're sitting there wondering whether that music was the Eroica Symphony, that we finished the last segment with it, no, it's something I did on a synthesizer. You'll have to go to YouTube or buy a CD. You've got to hear the Eroica Symphony, the Third Symphony of Beethoven. If you haven't experienced it, you must experience it. But let's get back to our story of God's hero and man's hero.
Okay, just before the break, I summarized a terrible incident in the conflict between Napoleon and Pope Pius VII in 1812. It's worth reminding ourselves that 1812 was a very significant year in the life of Napoleon. It was the year that he led his troops to defeat in Russia. The Russian victory over the French army in 1812 was a significant blow to Napoleon's ambitions of European dominance. This war was the reason the other coalition allies triumphed once and for all over Napoleon. Napoleon's army was shattered and morale was low, both for French troops still in Russia, fighting battles just before the campaign ended, and for troops on other fronts. Only one out of six of Napoleon's men survived, stumbling back to France half-starved. This Russian invasion was the decisive turning point for Napoleon and led to his defeat in exile on the island of Elba. It was an event of epic proportions and momentous importance for the rest of European history. So Napoleon's imprisonment of the Pope, which began before his Russian invasion and continued after its failure, occurred when Napoleon's state of mind must have been indeed very painful. Returning to Pius VII, he reigned over the Catholic Church during a very difficult period. Given the unfair things many people have said about other pontiffs, Pius VII remains widely respected, and almost surprisingly so. One can only imagine what would have been said of him if the counter-revolutionary forces had not prevailed in the Napoleonic Wars, and the many compromises he was obliged to make had to stand. Would then he be judged as harshly and unfairly as the other popes often are? We'll never know. We do know that Pius VII earned the respect of almost all the crowned heads of Europe by the handling of the many hardships he faced. Even Protestant states,
which had been hostile to the Catholic Church, were won over by this aristocratic monk from the region of Romagna, Italy. Few men have ever come to the papal throne under worse conditions, only to leave it in such a state of security, renewed through strength and political independence. He came from an aristocratic family, born in 1742, but not necessarily wealthy, so he grew up knowing the feeling of a proud heritage, along with the necessity of hard work and determination. He joined the Benedictines, took the name Gregory, eventually became a teacher. He was ordained priest, and his great career developed quickly. He was appointed Bishop of Tivoli and was made Bishop of Imola, given the red hat of a cardinal priest of the Basilica of St. Callistus. As a Benedictine, he'd been known as Don Gregorio. As cardinal, he was known as Cardinal Chiaramonte, because his baptismal name was Barnaban Niccolo Maria Luigi Chiaramonte. When Napoleon's French Revolutionary Army invaded Italy, the year was 1797, Cardinal Chiaramonte counseled temperance and submission to the newly created Cisalpine Republic, it was called. In a letter he addressed to the people of his diocese, Cardinal Chiaramonte asked them to comply, quote, in the current circumstances of change of government, to the authority of the victorious general commander-in-chief of the French army. In his Christmas homily of that year, he asserted there was no opposition between a democracy or a democratic form of government and being a good Catholic. He said, Christian virtue makes men good Democrats. Equality is not an idea of philosophers, but of Christ. I do not believe that the Catholic Church is against democracies. And then in 1799, 34 cardinals from across Europe gathered in a conclave to elect a successor to Pope Pius VI. Now, this may surprise you. The election wasn't held in the Sistine Chapel, not in Vatican City, and not even in Rome. Well, what prevented them from meeting in the Sistine Chapel, as they always do? Less than 2 years before, in February 1798, French troops had marched into Rome and seized Pope Pius VI and made him a prisoner. The Pope was sickly, and after 20 months imprisonment in a citadel, he died. While secularists ask how long the church could survive in the new age of the revolution, the members of the college prepared for the future. Rome was occupied, so the cardinals assembled at the Benedictine monastery of San Giorgio near Venice. In 1800, they chose the holy Benedictine cardinal Chiaramonte. He took the name of Pius VII, but there was little means for crowning the new pope because Napoleon's troops had seized the papal tiara. So without a papal tiara available for the coronation, the noblewomen of Venice paid for a papier-mâché papal tiara and adorned it with jewels from their own rings and necklaces. Very few in the conclave that elected Pius VII could have anticipated the severity of the struggle that awaited the Pope and the Church in the coming decades. For the new Vicar of Christ spent the next 15 years in battle with the dictator, Napoleon Bonaparte. Bonaparte was openly cursed as an antichrist and an enemy of civilization. Napoleon Bonaparte. The relationship between the emperor and the pontiff is one of the great spectacles of history, is one of history's amazing stories, for it is a powerful lesson to Catholics that the church has always been blessed by the successors to Peter, whose gifts have been provided at the moment when they were most needed. The determined holiness, fortitude and prudence of Pius VII meant that the Church would survive the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. Oh, my fellow faithful Catholics, think of this moment. This would-be master of all Europe was conquered in the most gentle way. Napoleon Bonaparte came in the end to lament. Alexander the Great declared himself the son of Jupiter. And in my time, I met a priest more powerful than I. Pope Pius VII saw clearly that the central crisis facing the church was Napoleon. To assist him, the Pope appointed as his Cardinal Secretary of State, Ercole Consalvi. Remember Consalvi for a moment. Something's about to happen. These two gifted men embarked upon a careful policy that prevented the destruction of the temporal and spiritual authority of the papacy, but also that held out room for future resistance.
to Napoleon's long-range ambition. And what was Napoleon's long-range ambition? Complete domination of Christ's Roman Catholic Church. Cardinal Consalvi negotiated with Napoleon the Concordat of 1801, which Napoleon promptly violated by adding to it articles that tightened his hold over the French Church. Against the advice of the Curia, Pius accepted Napoleon's invitation in 1804 to travel to Paris to crown him emperor, hoping thereby to win concessions from him. Pius VII celebrated the Mass at the infamous coronation on December 1st, at which the emperor seized the crown from the Pope and placed it upon his own head. Despite all these concessions, no modifications in Napoleon's policies were forthcoming. War broke out again the next year. Pius VII was resolutely neutral. Relations with the French Empire deteriorated steadily, especially after Napoleon won resounding victories against Prussia and Russia, and the Napoleonic shadow fell across the continent. This neutrality of the Pope was particularly maddening to Emperor Napoleon. In early 1806, the Pope wrote words that have been echoed by many other popes to dictators through the years. "No pope," Pius wrote, "should become involved in wars between states." And he concluded prophetically, quote, "If our words fail to touch your majesty's heart, we shall endure with resignation faithful to the gospel and accept every kind of calamity as coming from God." Remember the cardinal secretary, Consalvi? This is what happened. In reply, Napoleon forced Pius to remove Consalvi from his post as cardinal secretary. This was an omen of the dangers to come. It was only the start, as the emperor declared boldly, "I am Charlemagne, the sword of the church, and the clergy's emperor." My, what modest words. It became an elaborate chess game of move and countermove, followed over the next years, and Napoleon found himself constantly outmaneuvered by the humble old pope, who was undeterred by threats and French troops waiting to march on the Vatican itself. With mounting pettiness, Napoleon occupied Rome in 1808, arrested many of the cardinals, and finally imprisoned the Pope. With his papal government now under threat, Pius VII broke off all diplomatic relations with Napoleon. In answer, the dictator annexed the papal states, and Romans awoke to see the French tricolor flag flying over the Castel San Angelo on the banks of the Tiber River. The Castel San Angelo is on the very edge of the Vatican. The Pope met this move the very next day. Placards appeared suddenly all over the Eternal City with the announcement that Pope Pius VII had excommunicated all persons involved in the annexation, including Napoleon. Upon hearing that he had been excommunicated, Napoleon exclaimed, quote, "The old priest had clearly gone insane," and ordered his commander in Rome to arrest the Pope. So July 16, 1809, just before daybreak, French troops seized Pope Pius and brought him in a great rush to Savona between Nice and Genoa. After that, the Pope was a prisoner. He was isolated. He was isolated from his staff. He was isolated from everyone that wanted to see him. You know something? Napoleon failed to realize something. The Pope was never truly alone. And with each new outrage committed against the Catholic Church, the aged, sickened old monk just grew more powerful. Stick around after the break. See what happens next. This is Chuck Coughlin.
Redbox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
So we're back to see what happened next in the adventures of Pope Pius VII versus Napoleon Bonaparte, would-be emperor of the world.
The Pope's faithful cardinals remain unbending to Napoleon's wishes. Their adamant refusal to acknowledge Napoleon's divorce from the beloved Empress Josephine to marry the Austrian Princess Marie-Louise in 1810 was so great an embarrassment that he stripped them of their scarlet robes, all rights as cardinals, and even signed their death warrant before changing his mind at the last moment. And so France came to have their own version of Henry VIII, insisting on divorce and trying to destroy Christ's Catholic Church, which was only following Christ's instructions against divorce. And so it was. The cardinals could wear only their black cassocks, and so earned the honorific title among faithful Catholics of Black Cardinals. Black Cardinals, a title of great honor. When the emperor commanded that no newspaper should print any word of his excommunication or the pope's situations, devout Catholics secretly carried copies to Lyon, then distributed them across France. Word spread everywhere of the pope's seizure, and even the most ardent anti-clericalists in Europe were aghast at the degree to which Napoleon's regime had sunk into tyranny. In February 1810, Napoleon officially attached the Papal States to the French Empire as a free imperial city, and the Bishop of Rome was promised an annual income of 2 million francs. This sounds like a lot, but it was less than some of the empire's bureaucrats. To properly understand this action, you have to understand that Napoleon wanted to pay the salaries of all the clergy in order to control them. This is what is being done today in communist China. With their fake churches, they pay the salaries and control the message. This was what was done in Germany under Bismarck, to gain control and then destroy the church, or to utilize the church by controlling the message with money. So by paying Pius VII a salary, Napoleon not only insulted him, but symbolically tried to gain control over him. Meanwhile, Pope Pius VII lived in a condition of poverty in his jail cell, assisted only by his valet, who had to double as his secretary. The gendarmes spied upon him at every moment and subjected him to various humiliations. Pius refused steadfastly to accept the decree of 1810, and so faced more harsh and more harsh conditions. Napoleon became desperate to deliver a final blow to his prisoner. In 1811, he forced cardinals and bishops from the occupied territory to gather in a sham council in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris to raise charges against Pius VII. Instead, Napoleon's supposedly intimidated prelates gave a formal oath of loyalty to the Pope and made an appeal for his immediate release. A year after that, the Pope's physical condition in Savona began to alarm his supporters, including the Emperor of Austria, preparing for his massive invasion of Russia that was intended to mark the final conquest of Europe. Napoleon ordered the Pope move to Fontainebleau near Paris. So began that terrible journey that I related in the first part of this program, where Pope Pius VII, in precarious health, was cruelly dragged over the Alps to Fontainebleau in France, arriving at the gates of the castle nearly a corpse. You remember, my good listeners, Napoleon's instructions for the journey: to pass through the cities at night, no pontifical robes, traveling in such a way that nowhere would the Pope be recognized. He wore a black cassock, so he would be mistaken for an ordinary priest. Pius VII was bundled into a carriage and dragged over rough roads northward to France, high in the Alps. The agony of his blocked bowels and his inability to urinate went on for days, the horses galloping on. It was unbearable. He was delirious with fever. It was a miracle that the Pope reached Fontainebleau alive. There, encouraged by the French emperor to make public appearances and give assurance of his good health, Pope Pius declined, preferring to live in the palace as a humble Benedictine monk. He ate sparingly and even maintained his own tonsure in keeping with his monastic life of years before. Time passed. Then once more, Europe was convulsed by war as Napoleon's Grande Armée marched into Russia. This was the disastrous campaign that ended with Napoleon's retreat.
With his return from Russia in December of 1812, fateful year, Napoleon took time from resisting the imminent revolt to overthrow him to make peace with Pope Pius VII. So, Napoleon proposed a new concordat, which demanded various concessions from the Pope, and went himself to Fontainebleau in January of 1813. The two men had not met for 9 years, and both had changed considerably. The emperor, now 44, was an overweight, spent genius whose empire precariously tottered on a knife's edge. The pope, now 71, was emaciated and drained from years in captivity. Napoleon spent the next days relentlessly bullying the haggard pontiff into accepting his demands. Finally, the pope wearily gave his signature to what came to be called the Concordat at Fontainebleau. This concordat remained in effect till 1905. It sought national reconciliation between the French revolutionaries and Catholics, and solidified the Roman Catholic Church as the majority church of France, with most of its civil status restored, but it also ensured religious toleration for other sects and other religions. The hostility of devout Catholics against the state had now been largely resolved. However, it did not restore the vast church lands and endowments that had been seized during the Revolution and sold off. The faithful Catholic clergy was able to return from exile or from hiding and resume their traditional positions in their traditional churches. But what happened to all the priests, the parish priests, that Napoleon had appointed, the official priests? Well, very few parishes continued those priests. They would not accept them anymore. While the Concordat restored much power to the papacy, the balance of church-state relations did tilt in Napoleon's favor. He selected the bishops and supervised church finances. But the Concordat was useful to both sides. One of the items on the Concordat was Sunday. It was reestablished as a festival day, effective Easter Sunday, 18th of April, 1802. France still used the French Republican calendar, an atheist calendar that was later replaced by the traditional Gregorian calendar. The Gregorian calendar is, of course, a marvelous instrument used all over the world now in every nation, another gift of the Catholic Church to the world and to civilization. The ink still had not dried on the Concordat, but Napoleon leapt into action. Napoleon immediately and unfairly published the Concordat and released the black cardinals. A month later, the Pope, who had been exhausted by the negotiations and by Napoleon's bullying, recovered enough strength to publish a letter retracting his signature. Preoccupied with a massive war brought against him by virtually all of Europe, Napoleon allowed months to pass in fruitless negotiations with the Pope and his cardinals, who were at long last permitted to return to the Pope's side. In the end, Napoleon declared the Concordat in full force and began filling the long vacant sees and exiling anew the obstinate cardinals. Greatly satisfied with his new power to appoint bishops, Napoleon began to do so. These irregular bishops, these politically installed bishops, found faithful Catholics and clergy just as defiant as the black cardinals had been at Fontainebleau. So Napoleon banished seminarians and arrested priests who would not submit. By this time, however, his enemies were closing in. At the Battle of Leipzig in October 1813, Napoleon was defeated by a coalition of Austria, Prussia, Russia, and Sweden. France was then invaded. Frantic for allies to help him keep his throne, Napoleon offered to restore the Papal States and free Pius VII. But the pontiff calmly replied that it would be mere justice to return the Papal States. A deal was not necessary. It was the just thing to do. The invading forces were closing in on Fontainebleau. Napoleon realized that he was about to be greatly embarrassed by having the coalition rescue the Pope from his imprisonment. So Napoleon commanded that Pius be taken from Fontainebleau all the way back to Savonia, the long carriage ride back. When the Allies insisted that the Pope's release must be a condition of any peace, Napoleon at last sent him off toward the Austrian outposts in Italy. In March, the Allies entered Paris. Betrayed by his closest marshals, Napoleon surrendered and was exiled
to the island of Elba. After a legendary return of 100 days in 1815, he was defeated at the Battle of Waterloo in June by the combined armies of England and Prussia. Expelled from Europe, he was sent to the island of St. Helena under the watch of the English. The one-time ruler of an empire died there.
And now, Napoleon's former prisoner, Pope Pius, made a triumphant return to Rome. It was May in 1814. The Pope vastly improved in health, made a declaration to all of the Catholics and all of Catholicdom. The Pope sent this message. We have shed tears of grief in our prison, first of all because of our persecuted church, because we knew of her needs, but were powerless to do anything about it. And to all the people who suffered, we were powerless to do anything about your tribulation, without being able to bring them any comfort at all. The pride of the madman who set himself up as the equal of the Most High. After hearing those noble sentiments of the pontiff, it must be time for a break. This is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com, setting the record straight about God's hero versus man's hero.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight.
We're back on Setting the Record Straight with Chuck Coughlin, and we've been reflecting on the spectacular contest between the Emperor of the World, at least that's what he wanted to be, Napoleon Bonaparte, and the servant leader, the shepherd of the Catholic Church, and Pope Pius VII. Perhaps through miracles, perhaps through the sacrifices of men, perhaps through both, the gates of hell never prevail for long against the Catholic Church. And often its preservation is through the heroism and martyrdom of soldiers on the battlefield. We have to recognize that. Inspired by the justice which has been revealed to us. So now let us return to the story of Barnaba Niccolo Maria Luigi Chiaromonti, who reigned as Pope Pius VII. From March in 1800 to his death, 23 years later. He was also a monk of the Order of St. Benedict, a well-known theologian and bishop. As a monk, he took the name of Don Gregorio. He was a man of many achievements. With Napoleon defeated, he returned to Rome. He returned to the Vatican. He enjoyed heightened prestige and international favor. He moved quickly to secure the restoration of the Papal States. Then he corrected another great wrong, 1814. He reinstituted the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus, and gave it the task of helping to rebuild the shattered church in Europe. The courageous pontiff lived on until 1823. He led the church during one of the darkest periods in her history. He joined the declaration of the 1815 Congress of Vienna, urging for the suppression of the slave trade. This pertained particularly to places such as Spain and Portugal, where slavery was economically very important. He wrote a letter to King Louis XVIII and to the King of Portugal to urge the end of slavery. He rejected the slave trade and defined the sale of people as an injustice to the dignity of the human person. In his letter to the King of Portugal, he wrote, "The Pope regrets that this trade in blacks, that he believed having ceased, is still exercised in some regions, and even in a more cruel way. He begs and begs the King of Portugal that it implement in all its authority and wisdom to extirpate this unholy and abominable shame." He was an educated man, quite elegant, was fluent in Italian, French, English, and Latin.
And since he was a man of culture, he attempted to reinvigorate Rome with archaeological excavations in Ostia, which revealed ruins and icons of ancient times. He had walls and other buildings rebuilt and restored the Arch of Constantine. He ordered the construction of fountains and piazzas and erected the obelisk at Monte Pincio. He also made sure that Rome was a hospitable place for artists, and the leading artists of the time, like Canova and Peter von Cornelius, and many others gathered in Rome again. He also enriched the Vatican Library with numerous manuscripts and books. If you've ever seen the yellow and white flag of the Holy See,
which flies proudly over churches around the world,
it was Pius VII that adopted that flag as a response to the Napoleonic invasion.
On the surface, the church under Pope Pius VII seemed to be moving once again toward the power and prestige it had possessed during the last years of the ancient regime. However, Pius was forced to accept the fact that the church would be far less influential than the church of pre-revolutionary days. King Louis XVIII resisted any resumption of the papal jurisdiction in France, and the Austrian government, although well-disposed toward the papacy, would not repudiate the reforms made under Joseph II, which prior to the French Revolution had reduced ecclesiastical privileges and power. Nevertheless, Pius found the reactionary atmosphere prevalent throughout Europe satisfying to him. After the disasters of the French Revolution's attempt to create a humanistic utopia, he clearly saw the virtue in preserving the social permanence that had existed in Christendom for centuries. He clearly resisted all further social change. In Italy, the social legislation introduced in the Napoleonic era was repealed. Pius seconded this repudiation of the false steps of social reform, as so often has happened in history, through experimental progressive policies, though they may have been enacted for the best of reasons, so often come to disaster when based on humanistic strategies rather than strategies that align with the will of God. The Congress of Vienna, meanwhile, in its construction of a post-Napoleonic Europe, made some encouraging decisions for the papacy. The papal states had been returned to the Pope, and changes in diocesan boundaries were made to correspond with the new territorial settlements. There was a whole series of concordats with legitimate monarchs. Pius VII was glad to return to the papacy's long-time policy of seeking to live in harmony with governments that were administered by royal houses and not by atheistic revolutionaries. Pope Pius VII conducted negotiations with France for modifications of the Concordat of 1801. His repeated efforts in this direction, however, proved unsuccessful. The French government, with its traditional determination to control the clergy within its borders, was unwilling to yield to Rome the jurisdiction it had so recently wrested from it. Overall, Pope Pius VII believed that the Church, in order to retain its integrity and in order not to descend to the level of a series of weak national churches, had to reassert itself. He believed that the papacy needed to strengthen itself and to maintain at least some measure of authority over the clergy of the countries of Europe. He undertook this large step in his last years, although he knew he could not complete it. He died on August 20th, 1823. And he died a hero. When he witnessed the United States under President Thomas Jefferson
undertaking the first Barbary War to suppress the Muslim Barbary pirates along the southern Mediterranean, ending their kidnapping of Europeans for ransom and slavery, he declared that the United States, quote, had done more for the cause of Christianity than the most powerful nations of Christendom have done for ages. For the United States, he established several new dioceses: Boston, New York City, Philadelphia, and here in Kentucky, the huge diocese centered in Bardstown. Later, he also established dioceses of Charleston, Richmond, and Cincinnati. When he died, he was briefly interred in the Vatican grottoes, but was later buried in a magnificent monument in St. Peter's Basilica
In 2007, the Holy See contacted the Diocese of Savonanole with the news that Pope Benedict XVI had declared that nothing stands against the cause of beatification of Pius VII. He now has the title of Servant of God. But before his death, he also had one more remarkable act to perform. At a time when the relatives of Napoleon Bonaparte were pariahs everywhere, Pope Pius VII kindly issued an invitation to Napoleon's mothers and sisters to reside under his protection in the Papal States. It was a fitting act for the former monk, who Napoleon, looking back in time and with regret, while waiting to die on St. Helena Island, had referred to Pius VII as an old man full of tolerance and light.
Oh, yes, one more thing. What about Beethoven in his Bonaparte Symphony? Well, here's what happened. Several of his close friends were with him and saw the symphony on his table, beautifully copied in manuscript, with the word Buonaparte inscribed at the very top of the title page, and Luigi von Beethoven at the bottom. You have to realize that Italian was the preferred language for musicians of that period, no matter whether they were Austrian or German or French. So one of these friends was the first to tell Beethoven the news that Bonaparte had declared himself emperor. Beethoven broke into a rage and yelled, "So he is no more than a common mortal. Now he too will tread underfoot all the rights of man. He will indulge only his ambition. Now he will think himself superior to all men and become a tyrant." Beethoven went to the table, seized the top of the title page, tore it in half, and threw it on the floor. He later recopied the page, and it was now that the symphony received the title Eroica Symphony, Hero Symphony, a symphony dedicated to a hero, an anonymous hero. In the end, almost everyone deserted Napoleon.
And what about Beethoven? He was too much of a democratic idealist to dedicate anything at all to Napoleon. He had great ideals. He entertained great ideals about the brotherhood of man. And remember, Beethoven was a Roman Catholic. Beethoven composed two beautiful masses, the Mass in C, and this huge structure, the Missa Solemnis, the Solemn Mass. My gosh, I've performed it in a chorus. It's quite difficult, but absolutely incredible music. So when Beethoven tore up the title page to obliterate Napoleon's name, I'm glad he didn't have an impulse to tear up the whole symphony. I treasure it so. Beethoven was wise enough to know that somewhere, noble men and noble women did exist, were noble and idealistic emotions. It is those men and women's hearts that are reflected in his symphony. So, as it turned out, this symphony to an anonymous hero is actually dedicated to the noble principles to which we all aspire, that are human principles. I've greatly enjoyed doing this program. I hope you've enjoyed it as much to hear it. It's a great story. On Breadbox Media, this is Setting the Record Straight. I'm Chuck Coughlin, thanking you.